Audible.com, home to over 60,000 audiobooks and more. Details on how to download an audiobook, including the Thalia Book Club and selected short series, are at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
Didn't misery imply a wallowing sort of wretchedness? And a teacher had no time for that. The curriculum was always marching on, relentlessly. The ancient Egyptians melting into the ancient Greeks, the blur of check marks and smiley faces, the hot rattling breath of the photocopier, book reports corrected shakily on the bus, the eternal night of parent-teacher conferences, dizzy countdowns to every holiday, and the dumb animal pleasure of rest. One could be quite unhappy and never have a chance to know it.
You're listening to Joanna Gleason reading from the story Yurt by Sarah Shunlian Bynum, which we will hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Ever since God forbade Adam and Eve to taste the fruit of the tree of knowledge in the garden, the theme of forbidden fruit has been the source of many provocative stories, two of which we'll hear on this particular broadcast. The first story, Yurt, by Sarah Shunlian Bynum, was included in the Best American Short Stories of 2009, edited by Alice Siebold. It's a tale of faculty life and loves in an American middle school. In it, the forbidden fruit is not literally fruit, but rather a dream of a way of life which hangs there for the grasping. Our reader is Joanna Gleason.
A year ago, Ms. Duffy, the fifth-grade English and history teacher, had come very close to losing it, what with her homeroom being right next to the construction site for the new computer lab, and her attempts to excise the Aztecs from the curriculum being thwarted, and her ill-advised affair with Mr. Polidori coming to an end. She had come very close. Or at least that was the general opinion among both the middle and upper school faculty, and who is Ms. Hempel to disagree? But now, upon her return, Ms. Duffy looked unrecognizably happy. It was the first week of May, and she was holding court in the teacher's lounge, her hair nearly down to her waist, and her big belly protruding over her lap. Above the belly, Ms. Duffy laughed and swayed and gestured freely with her hands as if to say, "What, this old thing?" Ms. Hempel couldn't take her eyes off it. It looked as tough as a gourd. "Yemen is magical," Ms. Duffy was telling the handful of teachers who happened to have fourth period free. "Just unbelievable. The pictures don't capture it at all." A stack of dun-colored photographs was circulating around the room. After her difficult year, Ms. Duffy had sublet her apartment and struck out for the ancient world. There had been long and poetic emails, reasonably free of gloating. They were full of figs, marketplaces, bare feet against cool tiles, shuttered naps at noon. In between classes, Ms. Hempel had stood in front of the faculty bulletin board and read about Ms. Duffy's naps, trying to detect in all these messages a note of melancholy, of homesickness. "Miss you all," Ms. Duffy would write in closing, but the absence of a subject, as well as the excessive punctuation, made the sentiment seem less than heartfelt. And then the emails had abruptly stopped. Ms. Hempel studied the photograph that had been passed to her, a blazingly bright and empty street with the tiny figure of Ms. Duffy standing at its center. Who had taken the picture? A Yemenese friend? A Yemenin? It seemed important to know a little more about the person who'd stood in the shade of those massive, intricate buildings and pointed the camera. Perhaps this was the first of many foreign transactions that had resulted so spectacularly in Ms. Duffy's new belly. Ms. Hempel waved the photograph in the air. "Anna, where was this one taken?" But Ms. Duffy was distracted as more of her former colleagues filtered in to embrace her. "You astound me," Mrs. Willoughby said, pressing her clasped hands to her lips, a gesture she normally bestowed upon seniors who were making their final appearance in the spring choral concert. Ms. Duffy looked triumphant. Her face shone. Gone was the faint grimace that had once been her habitual expression. This wasn't like the first week of school when the teachers turned up in shorts and sundresses and still had their summer tans. Ms. Hempel remembered the shock of seeing Mr. Polidori's brown, hairy calves for the first time. The change in Ms. Duffy seemed permanent, irreversible. "Have you seen your kids?" Ms. Cruz, the assistant librarian, asked. "They'll go crazy." "They will freak," Ms. Mulcahy said. "Suzanne, where's the sixth grade now? Are they at lunch?" "They're in gym," Ms. Sprague said. "That's all I've heard this year. Ms. Duffy, Ms. Duffy. They can't write their own names without mentioning Ms. Duffy." "I miss them," Ms. Duffy said vaguely. "You won't believe how big they are. Huge. Amy Weiland is wearing a bra now." From his cubicle, Mr. Meacham moaned, "Must we?" And Mrs. Willoughby, peering into her coffee, said, "That girl's going to have a great little figure." "Amy Weiland?" Ms. Duffy echoed. "Yes, can you believe it?" Ms. Olin, teacher of sixth grade French, nearly shouted. She appeared slightly feverish. In fact, everyone did. Everyone seemed eager and a little overheated. There was so much to tell. Jonathan Hamish had got suspended. Travis Bent had gone on medication. Mr. Peel had agreed to turn on the air conditioning early, and oh, the computer lab was finally done. Ms. Duffy needed to be apprised and ushered back into the world they all had in common. The merry, frantic din of school rose up around them, louder and louder, as Yemen, fascinating and dusty, drifted farther away. Ms. Hempel placed the photograph back on its pile. She would have a chance to find out more eventually. She and Ms. Duffy were friends, school friends, in the sense that they were both part of the group of younger teachers who liked to gather at a dark Irish bar as soon as the bell rang on Friday afternoons. Ms. Hempel watched as Ms. Duffy was escorted out of the faculty lounge in search of her former fifth graders. "Look who's here," Ms. Olin cried, leading the way. The whole display was affecting but naive. Did they all think that Ms. Duffy was back? That once more there would be field trips to Chinatown for soup dumplings and scavenger hunts in the botanic gardens and sing-along to the meat puppets and other college radio stars of the 80s? That the Temple of Dendur would once more be erected in all its cardboard and tempera glory and the final bittersweet pages of Tuck Everlasting read aloud in Ms. Duffy's husky, choked-up voice? Ms. Hempel knew better. She'd known as soon as she'd seen her. Anna Duffy wasn't ever coming back. Not even after her big, hard belly had resolved itself into a baby. Most likely, necessity had prompted this visit. She probably needed to empty her locker or roll over her retirement plan. Didn't the others see? She was no longer one of them. At some point during her year off, she had turned away, slipped into her civilian clothes, and disappeared. And if she was back now, it was only to say goodbye. Mooney's, the Irish bar, was just a few blocks away from the school. Beautiful Ms. Cruz, who really did lead the fabled double life of the librarian, had discovered it one night while careering through town with a free jazz drummer nearly twice her age. It had been their last stop. What must Ms. Cruz have thought when they finally left the place an hour before dawn and she realized, looking up and down the avenue for a taxi, that she was just around the corner from her desk, her rubber stamps, her little stack of overdue notices? Maybe she thought, how perfect, to feel one's real life rub up so closely, so carelessly against one's school life. There was no greater enchantment. Or so Ms. Hempel supposed, never having put enough distance between the two to experience herself. She liked to hear Ms. Cruz talk in her calm and self-effacing way about all the old musicians she had fallen for, the hard-drinking drummer included. Ms. Cruz had taken him home with her that night, and the next Friday, she had brought the teachers to Mooney's. The narrow space was illuminated by a string of colored Christmas lights and a glowing clock. A jukebox stood in the back, and in between the cave-like entrances to two unisex bathrooms. Battered black tables, highly unsteady stools, linoleum floor. The floor was wonderful to dance on. It made Ms. Hempel feel graceful and coordinated even before she started drinking. All the teachers loved to dance on Friday afternoons. The sticky blinds on Mooney's windows were always pulled shut, so it was easy to forget that it was only 4 o'clock and the sun was still shining outside. They danced as if it were the middle of the night, They did the hustle. They did the electric slide. They did silly moves they remembered from high school, and they looked good doing them. When Mr. Radovich tried to dance as if he were black, no one minded. They were too happy feeding quarters into the jukebox, shimmying back to the bar. As she bumped hips with Ms. Cruz and sashayed toward the bathrooms, Ms. Hempel realized that an awful mistake had been made. She had actually been meant to spend her whole life dancing, not teaching English to the seventh grade. For someone who had an abundance of freckles and almost always wore clogs, Ms. Duffy could dance astonishingly well. She tossed back her hair and half-closed her eyes and lifted her chin ever so slightly as if a handsome, invisible person were tilting her face up to kiss her. And then she stepped from side to side with a barely discernible motion in her hips, her spine long and straight, her shoulders faintly twitching. It was the simplest dance in the world, and almost the most beguiling somehow. Other dancers drew close to her unconsciously. She could often be found in the middle of a spontaneous dance sandwich. One afternoon, Mr. Polidori had sprung from his bar stool, cracked his knuckles, and slid across the linoleum floor on his knees, arriving breathlessly at her neatly shuffling feet. Ms. Hempel liked to think that this was the moment that their romance had begun. Of course, she could be wrong. Mr. Polidori performed such extravagant gestures all the time, kissing your hand in gratitude, wrapping his fingers around your neck and gently throttling you, draping his arm across your shoulders with comradely affection, gestures that thrilled Ms. Hempel whenever she happened, through luck or proximity, to be the recipient of them. Her skin on fire, she felt how ridiculous it was to be thrilled. You could not, as a rule, take Mr. Polidori seriously. And that afternoon on the dance floor, Ms. Duffy did not appear to do so. When he came gliding toward her, his arms outspread, she merely offered him her hand and hoisted him up, never once losing the beat of her winsome little dance. But what if, as their hands joined, a secret message had been exchanged, a message that had taken them both by surprise? Ms. Hempel sometimes thought of this moment now as she tried to piece together a story of what had happened. How interesting it would have been to witness the very inception of an affair. She could have hoarded up the image, him on his knees, her swaying above him, to share with Amit when he came home. Often, walking dreamily home from the bar, the afternoon light slanting across the pavement, Ms. Hempel found herself full of marvelous observations and stories to relate to him. But then she went inside and it got dark. She turned up the television and felt a headache coming on, and by the time Amit returned from the lab, she couldn't think of anything to say, even when he wrinkled his nose and asked mildly, "How come you smell like cigarettes?" Ms. Hempel wondered about the father of Ms. Duffy's baby, a slow-eyed camel driver singing under his breath, a poet studying English at the university, or maybe a young doctor who had led her through a bazaar. She spent much of the day's final period considering the possibilities. And if, in her speculations, she caught a whiff of something faintly rotten and imperial, she ignored it. Of all the wonderful novels E.M. Forster had written, A Passage to India was her favorite. It made her wonder, were there any caves in Yemen? Caves that Ms. Duffy could have wandered into to explore and then stumbled out of, dazed and transformed? At the entrance to the library, Ms. Cruz sat behind her enormous wraparound desk. It resembled a sort of cockpit, its high sides studded with librarian paraphernalia, Ms. Cruz wheeling expertly about the interior in her ergonomic chair. The desk had two levels. The lower level was intended solely for the librarian's use, while the upper level was used by anyone who wanted to stand around bothering the librarian, as Mrs. Willoughby was doing now. "Did you see?" Mrs. Willoughby turned to Ms. Hempel with excitement. Then she remembered, "Oh, yes, you were there. Isn't she gorgeous?" Ms. Hempel said, "Gorgeous." And very, she extended her arms. I know. Not what we expected. I thought she'd come back with a slideshow and some nice scarves, but no, so much more. She leaned toward Ms. Cruz, resuming, 35 miles from the nearest hospital. Isn't that madness? There's a midwife. She'll be fine. Well, of course she will be, but still, out in the middle of nowhere, with your first child, you have no idea. She was tired of living here. She said so all the time. You girls don't know what it's like. You get so lonely at the beginning. You're tired. Your nipples hurt. You can't remember what day it is. Roman will be there. And they're building a second yurt, Ms. Cruz said firmly and glanced up at Ms. Hempel. Anna is moving upstate, she explained. But that explained nothing. A yurt? Ms. Hempel asked. Is that something Yemenese? She blushed. Mongolian, Mrs. Willoughby said. I had to ask, too. Not everybody who teaches here is a walking encyclopedia. It's a big circular tent made out of animal skins. Or in Anna's case, some fancy state-of-the-art flame-retardant fabric. Mrs. Willoughby conjured up a miniature yurt with her hands in the air. Not like a teepee, more like a circus tent made out of yaks. But the father, Ms. Hempel asked, is he from Yemen? Mrs. Willoughby looked at her peculiarly. Heavens no! For the trip abroad had been cut short. Something in the food had made Ms. Duffy sick, dangerously so. Only 2 months out of the country and she was doubled over shitting water. This explained the end of the lyrical emails. Ms. Duffy had lost nearly 20 pounds by the time she'd crept onto the airplane and come home to convalesce at her mother's. It was there that, looking pale and otherworldly, she had met Roman, a kite artist. He was visiting his mother, too, Ms. Cruz said. They're neighbors in the condo complex, the one her mother moved to after the divorce, Mrs. Willoughby said. Anna claims that it's soulless and horrible, but maybe she feels different now. Wow, Ms. Hempel said, collecting herself. So the father of Ms. Duffy's baby was an American whom she'd met in the courtyard of an ugly condominium. Being a kite artist, that's his job, she heard herself asking. Ms. Cruz nodded. He's a master. You can find him on the internet. He spends all day making kites and flying them. How wonderful, Ms. Hempel said uncertainly. I'd like to do that. Oh, wouldn't we all, Mrs. Willoughby said, and took a great breath. And for a precarious moment, it looked as if she might sing the chorus of Let's Go Fly a Kite. But the opportunity passed. There's family money, too, of course, and a big piece of land passed down through the ages. Anna's living on an estate, in a yurt, admittedly, but still. Pretty grand. Isn't this what they call marrying up? She got married? Ms. Hempel asked, startled. She hadn't seen a ring. A delicate look passed between the two other women. Ms. Hempel caught it and felt her skin prickle. It happened very quickly, Ms. Cruz said. As it so often does, Mrs. Willoughby added. One minute you're all alone, and the next, boom, you're standing there in City Hall with the man of your dreams. And moving upstate, Ms. Hempel said, and having a baby. Exactly, Mrs. Willoughby said, with a slap of her hands on the top of Ms. Cruz's desk. That's the trick of life, how much everything can change. And then squeezing Ms. Hempel's arm, she asked, remember, Anna was miserable. But Ms. Hempel wouldn't have described her as miserable, and she doubted that Ms. Duffy would have used the word herself. Because didn't misery imply a wallowing sort of wretchedness? And a teacher had no time for that. The curriculum was always marching on, relentlessly. The ancient Egyptians melting into the ancient Greeks, the blur of check marks and smiley faces, the hot rattling breath of the photocopier, book reports corrected shakily on the bus, the eternal night of parent-teacher conferences, dizzy countdowns to every holiday, and the dumb animal pleasure of rest. One could be quite unhappy and never have a chance to know it. Ms. Hempel was sometimes astonished by the thoughts she'd have while walking to work. One morning, she looked longingly at a patch of ice on the pavement and realized that if she were to fall and fracture her leg in several places, then she wouldn't have to go to school. And maybe if the doctors put her in traction, a substitute would be hired for the rest of the year. Perhaps she'd need a body cast. There was a way out, an honorable and dignified way out. All she had to do was undergo a terrible accident. But then her desk would be emptied in her absence, and all her secrets would come scuttling forth, the torn and smelly pair of stockings, abandoned there months ago, the descriptive paragraphs that had taken her so long to grade she'd finally claimed to have lost them at the laundromat, the open bag of Doritos, and, embarrassment aside, she had responsibilities. The volleyball finals were fast approaching. Who would keep score? Someone else would have to chair the weekly meetings of the girls' after-school book group and conduct the middle school assembly on Diversity Day. And who would finish grading the Mockingbird essays, adhering to the Byzantine rubric she'd devised? The fact was, no one could. "Call in sick," Amit would say sleepily, his arm flung over her. "Tell them you caught a cold." He'd kiss her. "You're infected and extremely contagious. You need to stay in bed, okay?" But she would already be staggering toward the shower. Had Ms. Duffy ever thought about slipping on the ice? Probably not. Her thoughts likely took a more enraged and practical turn. Probably as she waited for the bus, she drafted letters of resignation in her head, letters that described in withering detail the incompetence of the new middle school director or the shabby state of the women's second-floor bathroom. Ms. Duffy was so thoroughly good at complaining. She'd begin, dryly enough, with a sigh and a little self-mocking smile, but soon the full force of her indignation would take over, and her complaints would build in hilarity until she was magnificent to behold, her whole body radiant with fury. Often her stories ended with poor Mr. Mumford, the head of the middle school, saying, "Now, Anna, just calm down," a phrase that even when recollected in the yeasty tranquility of Mooney's made Ms. Duffy utter a murderous, strangled scream. "Ah!" From the end of the bar, Mr. Polidori would raise his glass to her. The gesture was perfectly in character, joking, wry, yet also somehow gallant. He would then return his attention to Mimi Gertz, the person whose company he appeared to enjoy more than anyone else's. She ran the art department and made sculptures out of giant nails. She was 15 years his senior and went on long bike trips with her girlfriend. Yet he, a teacher of physics, seemed always full of things to say to her. A mystery. But no more a mystery than his affair with Anna Duffy. Affairs. Flings. Apparently they happened all the time and between the people you'd least expect. "You didn't know about me and Phil?" Ms. Cruz asked, leaning forward in her ergonomic chair. Phil McCrae taught life science to the sixth grade. Beardless and cowlicked, he looked as if he himself had only recently completed the sixth grade. Ms. Cruz also had sex with Mr. Rahimi, the computer teacher, and Jim, who ran the after-school program. "It got a little weird," she said. Things had also got weird, Ms. Cruz revealed, for Mrs. Bell and Mr. Blanco. So weird, in fact, that he had had to go teach at another school for a few years until the conflagration finally died out. "Julia," Ms. Hempel cried in dismay. She loved Julia Bell, who taught both remedial and advanced math. "This was ages ago, long before you came to us," Mrs. Willoughby said. "But Daniel," Ms. Hempel cried, "I thought he was gay." "Oh, no, no, whatever gave you that idea? He's just Spanish." And incredibly, the former lover of Mrs. Bell. With his pointed goatee and his funny little vests, it was very hard to picture. Perhaps in a younger version, his ambiguous sexuality had actually been quite dashing, even irresistible. So much so that Julia Bell, a teacher blessed with pluck and humor and sense, had risked everything to be with him. "This was before the boys were born?" Ms. Hempel asked. "Wally was 2, I think, and not yet in school, but Nathan had already started kindergarten." Mrs. Willoughby raised her eyebrows. "It could have been a real mess." Unthinkable. Julia making a mess. Which was exactly why Ms. Hempel adored her, the serene, amused, and capable air, the way she kept an easy sense of order among even the most fractious children, the affection that her sons heaped upon her, tackling her in the middle of the hallway. She also had a plume of pure white hair growing from her right temple. She was the Susan Sontag of 8th grade algebra. Her husband taught math, too, at the State University. They had fallen in love during graduate school. And all this world of boys and equations and good cheer had been hazarded and then recovered. Now she could sit in faculty meetings with Daniel Blanco and not show the slightest sign that he was in any way special. If it weren't for the older teachers like Mrs. Willoughby who remembered, there would be no trace left of the perilous affair. Ms. Hempel couldn't decide which amazed her more, the sight of Mrs. Bell and Mr. Blanco talking amiably by the coffee urn or the thought of them locked in an urgent, hopeless embrace. Leaving the library, Ms. Hempel was surprised to find Ms. Duffy standing alone in the vestibule, her hands resting lightly atop her belly. She seemed to have lost her entourage somewhere along the way. She was looking at the enormous bulletin boards that lined the walls and displayed the latest projects generated by the younger grades. Only a year ago, she had been responsible for filling such a board, a task that required judiciousness, for not every child's hieroglyph could be hung, and a protracted struggle with crepe paper and a staple gun. But now she was free of that. She gazed at the artwork with the cool eye of an outsider. "Beatrice," Miss Duffy said, and Miss Hempel gave her a hug. "Have you seen this?" She pointed to the fifth grade bulletin board. "The projects are overlapping. You can't read them. And he put a staple right through that kid's name." He being Mr. Chapman, Wall Street trader turned teacher, called in to replace Miss Duffy for the year, and now it seemed quite possibly for good. "How are we supposed to know who drew the Minotaur?" she asked. "A child spent hours, hours working on this, and you can't even read his name." "The name is kind of obscured," Miss Hempel agreed, peering at the display. "My God," Miss Duffy muttered, "this isn't rocket science." She reached up and pinched the staple between her thumb and forefinger. With a worrying motion, she extracted it and then flicked it to the ground like a cigarette butt. The child's name was Lucien Nguyen. "Much better," Miss Hempel said and smiled. She wanted to leave. Her curiosity dulled now that she knew Miss Duffy wasn't harboring a little half-Yemenese baby. But Miss Hempel's tendency to suggest precisely the opposite of what she actually wished in the vague and automatic hope of pleasing someone asserted itself. "Do you want to walk to Izzy's and get a bubble tea, my treat?" For a moment, it looked as if Ms. Duffy were going to agree, but just as she was turning away from the displays, she inhaled sharply and wheeled back around. Her finger landed on a piece of pink paper, then circled a single word. "Did you see this?" The text was printed in a computer's version of girlish handwriting. "Persephone picked up the pomegranate and ate four of its seeds." Ms. Hempel winced. "Oomph, not good." "They're kids," Ms. Duffy said. "They make mistakes, but how are they going to know that they've made mistakes if their teacher hangs them up on the f***ing wall? I mean, does he make them do drafts? Does he correct anything?" Ms. Hempel shrugged weakly. Her own alertness to error had wavered over the years. But maybe all it took was some time away, some time abroad, for one's acuity to be restored, because now, simply standing beside Ms. Duffy, she could feel her powers beginning to return. The mistakes were leaping out at her, the bulletin board lighting up with offenses. "Upper right-hand corner," she told Ms. Duffy. "Completely random capitalization. Since when is swan a proper noun?" Or rape, for that matter. Though she had to admit both choices had their own logic. She also spotted Aries for Aries, altar in the place of altar, and there it was again, that old devil Itz. The real wonder of it all was how these mistakes managed to survive spell check. You had to kind of love them for it, for being indestructible. Ms. Duffy was pulling Persephone off the wall. "Where's Leda?" she demanded. There was now a naked, pockmarked hole on the board. "Up there," Miss Hempel said, a little reluctantly. Ms. Duffy rose up onto the very tips of her clogs, like a ballerina in toe shoes. Her belly didn't seem to throw her off balance. Up, up, her puffy fingers reached, quivering with purpose. "Got it," she gasped. Down came Leda. Down, too, came Hera and the peacock. Echo and a weedy-looking Narcissus. Danae dripping wet in her shower of gold. Down came the Minotaur and Medusa. Hermes, Neptune, Athena leaping bloodily from her father's splitting head. "Neptune, wasn't that the name the Romans used?" "Exactly," Ms. Duffy said. Ms. Hempel gazed at the pillaged display, felt afraid, and looked down the hallway in the direction of help. She wondered briefly why she, of all the young teachers who drank too much at Mooney's, had been chosen by Ms. Duffy to share this particular mission. Perhaps it was simply chance. The end of the day, an empty vestibule, a surge of nameless emotion, and then someone emerges making you not alone anymore. So it had happened a year ago with Mr. Polidori. "Out of the blue," Ms. Hempel had asked Ms. Duffy at the time, "the two of you just..." She could not believe it then, but now, holding the plundered goods against her chest, it made a sort of sense to her. It was easy to find oneself, without warning or prelude, embroiled. She crouched down and tapped the papers against the floor, neatening the pile, making a crisp little sound, wanting above all to avoid the appearance of untowardness, wanting the whole operation to feel as tidy, as considered as possible. They agreed, finally, that the best thing would be to return the projects, with a carefully worded note attached, to Mr. Chapman's classroom. My room was how Miss Duffy referred to it. And then she alarmed Miss Hempel by asking, "You're going to sign it too?" No, she was not. But she didn't have the heart to say so yet, especially now that Miss Duffy had been seized by some fresh distress. As the fluorescent lights flickered in on the classroom, she looked about her wildly. Things were not as she had left them. The purple beanbags were still in the reading corner, and the jade plants were thriving, having been faithfully watered by Ms. Cruz. The record player was there, too, although it was buried under stacks of handouts, and the Calder-mobile still dangled from the ceiling. But the Indonesian shadow puppets were gone, and so were the poems. "He took down my poems?" Miss Duffy's voice was small. She had gone to great lengths to procure them, even risking arrest. A few years earlier, the poems had begun appearing on subways and buses, alongside the advertisements for credit repair and dermatologists. As soon as a new poem was posted, Ms. Duffy would devise a plan for obtaining it, scouting out empty subway cars, climbing up onto the scarred seats, easing the poem from its curved plastic sheath, secreting it away beneath her long winter coat, all for the sake of her fifth graders. Every day, they could gaze up and contemplate the words, or not, and therein lay the beauty of osmosis. They passed the year in the company of Whitman and Dickinson, Mark Strand and Mae Swenson. Some of the poetry would penetrate even the most obdurate souls, which was probably the thinking of the Transit Authority as well. But the fact that her fifth grade's edification came at the expense of the citizenry did not seem to give Ms. Duffy pause. And then it became possible to acquire the poems lawfully by sending off a simple request on school letterhead. But Ms. Duffy, like all the best teachers, had a renegade spirit and continued to haunt the buses late at night. Now, in the place of her stolen poems, hung boldly colored posters urging the class to read and pointing out that reading is fun, that people everywhere should celebrate reading. Additionally, there was a poster commemorating a Super Bowl win of the Green Bay Packers. All of which, it was obvious, had been obtained through official channels. Ms. Duffy sank down onto one of the many little tables arranged throughout the room. The fifth graders didn't yet know the isolation of desk chairs. They still worked companionably at these low, shiny tables. She covered her face with her hands and sighed, her elbows digging into the high mound of her stomach. "I hope he put them somewhere safe," she said. "You want me to send them to you?" Ms. Hempel asked. No, there's no room. I just meant in case he changes his mind." She glanced over at what had once been her desk, at the piles she was no longer accountable for. "He has them doing those dumb workbooks," she asked, but all her earlier outrage was now exhausted. "It's his first year," Ms. Hempel said, and laid the ransacked myths on Mr. Chapman's desk. "He should take whatever shortcuts he can find." Ms. Duffy didn't answer. She was still looking around the classroom at the small ways in which it was now strange, at the names taped onto the backs of the chairs, names she would not recognize. She said, "I lost Theo McKibben at the Metropolitan Museum my first year." "Theo?" Miss Hempel laughed. "That's easy to do." "It was a nightmare, my first waking nightmare." "The first of many," Miss Hempel said. "But just think, you'll never have to go on a field trip again." Miss Duffy smiled slightly. "Never again." And then Ms. Hempel realized with a sick feeling that she had forgotten to distribute the permission slips for next week's outing to the planetarium. Only 3 days left. Not a problem for the organized students, but it didn't allow much leeway for the children you always had to hound. She would have to resort to an incentive plan: early dismissal, ice cream. She paced around the desk mindlessly and saw it as both hopeful and doomed. The careful stacks beginning to slip, colored pens littered everywhere, memos from Mr. Mumford protruding at odd angles, the plastic inbox taken over by trading cards, half-eaten candy bars, extra credit assignments on the verge of being lost. "You're brilliant," she turned to Ms. Duffy. "You are, because we can't leave to make more money. That's despicable. And we can't leave to do something easier, some nice quiet job in an office. That would be embarrassing. Am I supposed to tell my kids, 'Okay, I'm off to answer phones at an insurance company'? It's impossible. So what can we do? We can..." Ms. Gemple gestured helplessly at Ms. Duffy's belly. "Why didn't I think of that?" She had imagined a body cast instead. Again, Ms. Duffy gave her a thin smile. It wasn't clear whether she took Ms. Hempel's compliment as such. "So what's stopping you?" she asked idly. She plucked a long, loose hair from the sleeve of her blouse and dropped it onto Mr. Chapman's floor. Then she seemed suddenly to remember that she was pregnant and undergoing a remarkable experience. She lit up. "You should do it," she said with abrupt conviction. "You'll love it. You will." She pushed herself off the little table and began moving toward Ms. Hempel. "We think we have all the time in the world, but in reality we don't. And when you found the right person, you just have to go for it. There's never a good time. It's never convenient. Don't fool yourself into waiting for the perfect moment." She stopped. Her hands flew up to her mouth. "I'm so sorry." Ms. Hempel touched the fair, freckled arm. "Oh, don't worry. Please. Really, don't worry." "I'm an idiot," Ms. Duffy cried. "You're not," Ms. Hempel said, "because I forget, too. After I do the dishes, I get this panicked feeling that I've put my ring down somewhere, and now I can't find it." She lifted her bare hand and looked at it. Everything was friendly. It really was. Ms. Duffy nodded, her face stricken. "Amit and I still talk on the phone, and last week he sent me a book." She didn't mention that it was actually one of her books, a book that he had taken with him by mistake. "We're in very good touch," she said. Ms. Duffy was unconsoled. "What happened? What made you decide?" It was hard to keep straight. They had told people different things at different times. There was a Meets fellowship in Texas, which he couldn't turn down. There was the difficulty of finding time to plan a wedding, not to mention the expense. There was their youth, of course, and the uncertainty that comes with it, the fearful cloudiness of the future, and what a mercy that was to be considered at nearly 30, still hopelessly young. All of which was true, just as all of it was prevarication. And even in the midst of saying these things, she was never sure exactly whose feelings were being spared, who was being protected. For whose sake was all this delicacy required? She hated to think that it might be hers. "It wasn't the teaching, was it?" Miss Duffy asked. "Oh, no. It wasn't that, at least she didn't think so. But funny how everyone had a theory of her own." "It's not your father, is it?" her mother had asked. Her father had been dead for 2 years now, but at times she still found herself ambushed by his absence. She had told her mother no. It wasn't because she missed her father. And she had told Mr. Polidori no. It wasn't because of him, either. She was surprised that he'd even asked. It had been a startling glimpse of vanity, of self-importance. He had cornered her by the jukebox and gazed down at her earnestly, the earnestness itself a surprise. They had only kissed and nuzzled with some breathless pressing and hugging in the bathroom at Mooney's, ages ago, on one of those happy Friday afternoons, after he had ended things with Ms. Duffy, but before he had fallen for the gamine younger half-sister of Mimi Gertz. A pause between acts, there in the dark stall at Mooney's, everyone giddy with the rapid approach of summer. She had tumbled into the bathroom and found him back to the door, penis presumably in hand. And before she could even gasp, he had glanced over his shoulder, told her to wait, and then unhurriedly finished, washed his hands, and dried them with a sheet from a roll of gray paper towels, asking her, "Do you hate this song as much as I do?" They had danced, barely able to move. He had lowered the swinging latch into the little rounded hook by the door. "Forgot to do that," he said, and she'd laughed. Or had she? She would like to think that she had, that she had kept her wits about her and laughed, kept things floating along lightly, the encounter accidental and jolly. She would like to think that she hadn't swooned, hadn't shut her eyes and given way, tipped her head and held on. There had been no hesitation, only treachery, only readiness, a perfect swan dive into the dark pool of flings and affairs. Maybe she had let out a little moan, but then the song had come to an end and he had clasped her bearishly, pecked her on the forehead and said, "I'll bet you make all the boys crazy, Ms. Hempel." And after releasing the latch, he had gallantly held the door open for her. She walked obediently back to her seat at the bar, wondering, what just happened? Later she would return to this moment, flipping it back and forth like a tricky flashcard, one that somehow refused to be memorized. She had asked herself all the boring questions. Not pretty enough? Odd smell? Fiancé? But couldn't quite manage an answer. Causality kept escaping her. He had kissed her, and then he had changed his mind. That was as far as she ever got. But always fascinating to her was the fact that she had felt him changing his mind, felt it in her muscles and on her skin. Not that he had done anything as obvious as stiffen, and his body hadn't once let go of hers, yet something had shifted. The pressure that was once excited, now merely emphatic. The mouth, still warm, but only reassuringly so. The embrace turning into a squeeze. His body's gracious withdrawal of interest in the very moment that he decided, no, this really isn't for me. And though many things would reveal themselves in time, the sex of Ms. Duffy's baby, a girl, and her name was Pina, after the bleak choreographer. The name of the woman who worked at Amit's lab, which was Lily. The right word, the word she'd been looking for, Yemeni. Still, she returned to the bathroom at Mooney's, to its perfect mystery, to the moment when Mr. Polidori had wrapped his arms around her like a bear, that moment in which someone had made a decision. She wanted to remember how it felt.
Joanna Gleason read Sarah Shunlian Bynum's story, Yurt. After a quick break, we'll hear a story which John Updike described as a delicious trifle. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. In our second story on this program of fictions about forbidden fruits, the objects of forbidden desire are actually fruits. The story by Grace Stone Coates, who was born in Ruby, Kansas, and lived from 1881 to 1976, is entitled Wild Plums. And it is these fruits which the daughter of an austere and rigid farm family is eager to taste, but is forbidden to do so by her stern parents. In writing about this story in the 1999 volume Best American Short Stories of the Century, which he edited, John Updike described it as a delicious trifle, which he could not keep himself from including in the anthology. He wrote, quote, "In this story, a child tugs against her parents' puritanical caution and rural class consciousness. The obedient child, it seems, is being barred from the experience of life itself." Our reader is Maya Dillon.
I knew about wild plums twice before I tasted any. The first time was when the Sunday school women were going plumbing. Father hunched his shoulders and laughed without making any sound. He said wild plums were small and inferior and told us of fruits he had eaten in Italy. Mother and father were surprised that Mrs. Guare and the schoolteacher would go with Mrs. Slump to gather plums. I knew it was not nice to go plumbing, but I didn't know why. I wanted to go once so that I would understand. The women stopped at the house to invite Mother. She explained that we did not care for wild plums. But Father said, we feared to taste the sacred seed, lest we be constrained to dwell forever in the nether regions. Mrs. Slump said, huh? You don't eat the pits, you spit them out. And Father hunched his shoulders and laughed the noiseless laugh that bothered Mother. When Father talked to people he didn't like, he sorted his words and used only the smooth, best ones. Mother explained to me it was because he had spoken only German when he was little. After the women had gone, Mother and Father quarreled. They spoke low so I would not hear them. Just before Mother sent me out to play, she said that even wild plums might give savor to the dry bread of monotony. The second time I knew about plums was at Mrs. Slump's house when she was making plum butter. She said she couldn't ask us in because the floor was dirty from stirring jam. The Slumps didn't use chairs. They had boxes to sit on, and the children sat on the floor with the dogs. They were the only people I knew who had hounds. I wanted to go in. We never had visited them. We were at their house now because Father needed to take home a plow they had borrowed. Father didn't like to have his machinery stand outdoors. He had a shed where he kept plows when he was not using them, but the Slumps left theirs where they unhitched. Mrs. Slump was standing in the door with her back toward us when we drove up. She was fat and wore wrappers. Her wrapper was torn down the back. Mr. Slump came out and Father talked to him. He was tall and lean. Mrs. Slump came and stood by the buggy, too. Mother and Father sat on the front seat of the buggy, and Teresa and I on the back seat. Teresa was older than I and had longer legs. When she stretched her feet straight out, she could touch the front seat with her toes, and I couldn't. She bumped the seat behind Mother, and Mother turned around and told her to stop. My feet didn't touch Father's seat, so I wasn't doing anything and didn't have to stop it. Teresa pinched me. I climbed out of the buggy without asking if I might. Teresa started to tell Mother I was getting out, but waited to see what I intended to do. I was going to walk around behind Mrs. Slump. She had no stockings on, and the Sunday school women said she didn't wear underclothes. I wanted to see if this was so. Mother called me back. Sometimes Mother knew what I was thinking without asking me. She took hold of my arm hard as I climbed onto the buggy step and said under her breath, "I'd be ashamed. I'd be ashamed." Her face was twisted because she tried not to stop smiling at Mrs. Slump while she shook my arm. I kept trying to explain, but she wouldn't let me. Her stopping me made me want to say the thing she thought I was going to, but I didn't dare. Mr. Slump said he would bring the plow back in the morning. Father wanted to take it home himself then, but Mr. Slump said he wouldn't hear to it, being as how he had borrowed it and all. He would bring it behind the lumber wagon the next day and leave it in the road. They were going after more plums and would be passing the house anyway. The next morning after breakfast, Father, Mother, and I were in the kitchen. Teresa had scraped the plates and gone to feed the chickens. She did not like to sit still while people talked. She liked to do things that made her move around. Mother and Father were talking, and I was looking out of the window. If I looked at the sun and then away, it made enormous morning glories float over the yard. Father had told me they were in my eyes and not in the air, so I didn't call him to look at them. While I was watching them, Clubby Slump came up the lane in the middle of a lavender one. Clubby was bigger than I, and stupider. When anyone spoke to him, he stood with his mouth open and didn't answer. His hair needed combing, and he didn't use a handkerchief. Mother said good morning to him. He pointed to a wagon at the end of the lane. He said, "Plums," and ran back down the path. Mother and Father started toward the road, and I went ahead of them. The wagon had stopped at the foot of the cottonwood lane. Mr. Slump sat on the high board seat, holding the reins. Mrs. Slump was beside him, with the baby on her lap. Liney Slump was between them. On the seat behind were Mrs. Guare and two women I didn't know. The rest of the wagon was full of children. Mr. Slump had forgotten the plow. "All you uns pile in," Mrs. Slump called to us. "We're going plumbing on the Ninniskaw and stay all night. The young'uns can go wading. There ain't no work driving you this time of year, so just pile in. We got bedding for everybody." Mr. Slump sat looking at the horse's ears. Whenever Mrs. Slump stopped talking, he would say, "I told you they all wouldn't go, but you would stop." And Mrs. Slump would answer, "There now, Pa, you hush." I had not known one could live so long without breathing as I lived while Mrs. Slump was asking us to go. I could see my heartbeats shaking my collar. a lace collar that was hanging by one end down my chest. I had forgotten to put it on right. I waited for Mother to lift her foot and plant it on the wagon hub, ready for piling in, for Father to take her elbow and lift. Everyone would laugh a little and talk loud. They always did when women got into wagons. I had never seen Mother climb into a wagon, but I knew how it would be. I wondered if Father would jump in without tossing me up first. Father got into wagons quick, without laughing or joking. I wondered if he would forget me. The children would see me and lean over the end board and dangle me up by one arm. I thought frantically of Teresa. Then Father was speaking, and my breath came back. He was saying, "If you happen on a plum thicket, an outcome highly unlikely, you still face the uncertainty of finding plums. The season has been too dry, and should you find them, they will prove acrid and unfit for human consumption." My collar hung limp and motionless. My heart was dead. Father was spoiling things again. Mrs. Slump said, "They make fine gel." And Mr. Slump repeated, "I told you they all wouldn't go, but you would stop." He was gathering up the lines. I hated to see Mother's face, feeling the stricken look it would have, but I knew I must smile at her, not to care. Strangely enough, she had a polite look on her face. It was the look that made my fingers think of glass. My mind slipped off from it without knowing what it meant. She was smiling. "Really, it isn't possible for us to go with you today," she said. "It was kind of you to ask us. I hope you will have a lovely outing and find lots of plums." As she spoke, she glanced at me. She moved closer and took my hand. Mrs. Slump looked down at me, too, and said, "Can't the kid go? Kids like being out." Mother's hand closed firmly on mine. "I'm afraid not, without me. Besides," with a severe look at my collar, "she isn't properly dressed." "Oh, we can wait while she takes off that purty dress," Mrs. Slump suggested comfortably. But Mother flushed and shook her head. Mr. Slump was twitching at the lines and clucking to the horses. His last, "I told you," was drowned in shouted goodbyes, and the wagon clattered down the road. Mother walked back to the house, still holding my hand. Once inside, she turned to me. "Would you really have gone with those..." She hesitated and finished. "With those persons." "They were going to sleep outdoors all night," I said. Mother shuddered. "Would you have gone with them?" "Mrs. Guerra was with them," I parried, knowing all she did not say. "Would you have gone?" "Yes." She stood for a long time looking out of the window at the prairie horizon, then searched my face curiously. "It might have been as well," she said. "It might be as well." And turning, she began to clear the breakfast table. The next day, I played in the road. Usually, I spent the afternoons under the box elder trees or by the ditch behind the machine sheds where dragonflies and pale blue moths circled just out of reach. But this day, I spent beside the road. Mother called me to the house to bring cobs and called me again to gather eggs in the middle of the afternoon. She called me a third time. Her face looked uncomfortable. She said, "If the slumps go by, do not ask them for any plums." Mother knew I would not ask. "If they offer any, do not take them." "What shall I say?" "Say we do not care for them." "If they make me take them?" "Refuse them." When the slumps came in sight, the horses were walking. The Ninniskaw was 15 miles away, and the team was tired. I thought I could talk to the children as the wagon passed, but just before it reached me, Mr. Slump hit the horses twice with a willow branch. They trotted, and the wagon rattled by. The children on the last seat were facing toward me. They laughed and waved their arms. Clubby leaned backward and caught up a handful of plums. The wagon bed must have been half filled. He flung them toward me, and then another handful. They fell scattering in the thick dust, which curled around them in little eddies, almost hiding them before I could catch them up. The plums were small and red. They felt warm to my fingers. I wiped them on the front of my dress and dropped them in my apron. I waited only for one secret rite before I ran, heart pounding, to tell my mother what I had discovered. She interrupted me. "Did they see you picking them up?" I thought of myself standing like Clubby Slump, mouth open, without moving. I laughed till two plums rolled out of my apron. Oh, yes, I had them picked up almost before the dust stopped wriggling. I called, "Thank you." Still, Mother was not pleased. "Throw them away," she said. "Surely you would not care to eat something flung to you in the road." It was hard to speak. I moved close to her and whispered, "Can't I keep them?" Mother left the room. It seemed long before she came back. She put her arm around me and said, "Take them to the pump and wash them thoroughly. Eat them slowly and do not swallow the skins. You will not want many of them, for you will find them bitter and not fit to eat." I went out quietly, knowing I would never tell her that they were strange on my tongue as wild honey, holding the warmth of sand that sun had fingered and the mystery of water under leaning boughs. For I had eaten one at the road.
Maya Dillon read Wild Plums by Grace Stone Coates. This radio program is now available as a free podcast, so you can subscribe and listen to the download on your computer or MP3 player anytime, anywhere. Subscribe today on iTunes or at npr.org or pri.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Greetings to our Selected Shorts podcast audience. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders.